Hey there, Deviants. Happy St. Patrick's Day. We are back with a brand new episode that we hope will bring you some entertainment on a day that is very special to me.
That's right, everyone. You heard Patrick up at the top of the show. So, you know what that means? That means that it's a Chris episode today,
It
which
is.
is fun because it's been a minute and we are recording on St. Patrick's Day, which has a very special connection to my delightful co-host.
That would be me. If you're new here, hi, my name's Patrick. And I've always really loved St. Patrick's Day, because it's my name, right? And when I was a kid, because I have a summer birthday, and I didn't go to a year-round school. So when I was a kid, like all the kid other kids got to have like a birthday party at school. And my mom worked out with each one of my elementary school teachers that I had to allow me to bring St. Patrick's Day cupcakes on St. Patrick's Day, so I could have my party at school since I never got a party at school. And I
That's
think I'll
really cute. I like that idea.
Yeah, and I think I will always remember that. So thank you, mommy dearest. But then a fun fact that I learned about St. Patrick's Day this year was it truly is my day because we all know that I'm obsessed with cats. And I found out today that March 17th is also St. Gertrude of Nivelles Day. And St. Gertrude is the patron saint of cats and cat lovers.
Oh my gosh, that's a perfect
And
lineup. All the
look at
stars
her.
align.
Look
Oh,
at
she's.
her.
Oh, I love this picture. She's like a nun, and she is cradling a cat, and she's also flanked by other like two other cats.
Which is honestly me many days. Winnie is often on my lap, and Yuna is usually like on my shoulder with her head in my neck, and Hera is usually next to me on the other side. So I think I am her. I am Saint Gertrude.
Well, and I think there's a lot of other animal lovers that listen to our podcast, and so I'm hoping many of our wonderful listeners also feel that the same way, that hopefully today is a lucky cat-filled day for you.
And then also, just to keep up with tradition of St. Patrick's Day, I don't drink beer. I'm not a fan of beer. Also, I can't because it upsets my tummy. And I knew I could not have a margarita at 3 in the afternoon. So I got a Mike's Hard Seltzer with me,
Oh
which
yeah,
I'm.
if Mike's Hard Seltzer feels like sponsoring us, we'd gladly accept that.
Yes, we would. I've never had this one. It's a pineapple flavor. So,
I love pineapple. What's the verdict?
yeah, it's doable. I would have preferred a lemonade.
That's
But yeah.
really funny. It's like, here's this wonderful endorsement of this product. Like, yeah, it's doable. I could drink it.
Wait, Mike's, let me say, this is only to say that your original recipe reigns superior.
Okay, that's fair. It's kind of hard to like outshine the classic.
Correct,
You know.
correct. But also something that I would like to say here, complete segue away, off topic, but a good topic is I would like to wish all of our Muslim listeners who practice, I would like to wish you all a happy Ramadan, Ramadan Mubarak. Chris and I were talking. We know it's this year's Ramadan doesn't feel as joyous as it should because of the conflict going on in the Gaza Strip. Iftars are not as happy and joyous as they should be. And we also know that there are people on this trip who are not able to have those iftars because they don't have food. So just sending all of our love to not only the Palestinians in the Strip, but Palestinians outside of the Strip and just the whole Islamic community as a whole. We are sorry that this is happening.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's so much to take in. It's such a big thing happening right now, and the least we can do is to try and put those good vibes out there and just let people know that you're not forgotten, and
Correct.
That we understand that this is an important time of the year. This is, I mean, every religion has parts of their calendar that are special to them, and this is their time. And we really wish that you could be focusing on celebrating your faith rather than worrying about yourselves or others even having enough food to eat. Like, I mean, on this planet, we produce so much food. There should be enough food for everybody, and it's
Oh,
just a
there is. It's just
and
not getting to you.
it's
And
yeah, it's not getting to the people who need it. And so we're gonna just recognize that here up top, and really, if you are part of any faith, I hope that you are praying for peace and safety of all people everywhere.
And if you're not a person of a faith, just sending out those positive thoughts and those
Yeah.
hopeful wishes.
I think that's I yeah, if anybody has a problem with that, I there's something wrong with them.
Exactly.
All
You
right.
don't like us promoting peace and equality for all people, then please stop listening. I do
Yes,
not
hope
care if we lose you.
yeah, hopefully none of our we've got some pretty awesome listeners
I think
though.
we do.
I think we do.
And speaking of listeners, I forgot to mention this last episode, but we do have at least one listener in Croatia now. So welcome, Croatia.
Welcome to the team. Welcome to Team Dark and Devious.
Yes.
Yeah, and I wish that it would tell us exactly what episode it was that got that one person to listen.
I mean, I will
And
say number one has by far, like leaps and bounds, the most listens because I think people always click on the top one. And I
oh
really
yeah.
wish our audio quality was better because I'm like, I don't want that to be someone's first impression.
Right. It's like this isn't like a series. This isn't like a book series where we have to start at the beginning to understand the people later on. Like, no, just start with either whatever topic interests you or start with the most recent, because now we've had so much more time to improve and narrow
Yeah.
our scope.
But yes.
Yes.
But anyways, I guess I will just go ahead and share what I've been up to. I've been on spring break all week, which has been lovely.
So I imagine it's Patrick gone wild.
Yes, Patrick Gone Wild. You can order it from MTV. I remember always had those.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, I think we're showing our age.
We are. I know, like, our Gen Zs do not get this joke whatsoever. But no, it's been nice. It's been very relaxing. It's been a good reset. Tomorrow is going to be a slap in the face. I'm not ready for it.
Oh no.
But it's been nice. I've had a lot of downtime, but I've also been working on a project that my husband and I are both working on, and we made a lot of progress over spring break. I'll share news about that as we get closer to the finish. And then I did watch a very short series. Oh my gosh, I'm blanking on the name now. It's a Netflix documentary about, oh, it's called The Program. So it's very similar to like the one that I watched about, it's called Hell Camp, and also the same thing that Paris Hilton went through. And she's in both those documentaries, by the way. And it is wealthy people that think their child is mischievous or, you know, on the road to being living a crime-filled life, whatever. So they ship them off with, they hire people to literally come and kidnap their children from their homes. That's part of the program. It's part of their stick, and they take them away to these camps, and they're not allowed to leave until either they are quote unquote fixed and reformed, or their parents eventually, you know, miss them so much, because some of these kids were in the programs for like years.
Oh
And
my
it,
gosh, that sounds horrifying. I mean,
yeah,
it's...
and some are like wilderness themed, some are like conservation themed, some are like private school themed. And it's horrible what they do to these kids. They would make them unclog toilets with their toothbrushes or their bare hands, and then they have to brush their teeth using that toothbrush. They have to carry around like 50-pound weights all day for weeks at a time. They're put in solitary condition. They're often beat. A lot of sexual assaults occur, especially with the female girls.
Gosh, it
And the
sounds
thing
like
is, like,
it's supposed to be like a scared straight type thing, but
yeah,
only
but
like
it's
instead of just
brutal.
scaring you, they just actually
Abuse you.
abuse you. Yeah.
And there have been some that were shut down because kids died.
Ugh.
And the thing is, like, parents don't know. Parents are a victim too, because they are brainwashed. They have all this propaganda and pamphlets and films of the children like smiling, laughing, playing basketball, like cooking food together, but they're all staged. They're all forced to do these things. And then it's only for like one afternoon is life like that. And the rest of the time is just hell. So
My
I
God.
recommend this week that our listeners tune into The Program and also Hell Camp. And then Paris Hilton's documentary, there's a probably like a solid 30 minutes where she talks about her experience. So yeah, that is my recommendation. They are not feel good shows at all. I cried a couple times, but it's very interesting. It's very angering, and these programs are still running today all over the world.
That is just crazy. The whole like kidnapping aspect too, because I've heard of programs like that where they like just come in the middle of the night and they like do like a simulated kidnapping. Although really it's kind of like they're being kidnapped for real, but they're just sanctioned by the parents to do
Yeah.
that, which sounds like it should be illegal because I feel like that's a great way for someone to get hurt for real. Like if they think, like if they're really thinking they were going to fight for their lives, I imagine, well, one of the people working for whatever the organization is could get hurt, or like when they're trying to like fight back, the kids could get hurt too. It
Yeah.
just seems like it maybe shouldn't be legal, but I guess I don't know. Maybe some of that is addressed in one of those documentaries. I'll
Yeah.
be
And I
interested.
mean, one example that is Paris. She explained she was in her bed at night. Two men come in, literally just take her out in her pajamas. She's like half awake, screaming, fighting. She was like actively resisting. And she said, as she was being like taken out, she was being pulled past her parents and screaming, like, help, mom, dad, help me. And she just had to sit, stand there and watch as they just
Ugh.
stared and did nothing. And then her sister Nikki woke up during this, and she witnessed it as well. And then they just told Nikki, go back to bed. Next morning, Nikki wakes up, they're having breakfast. And then she started to ask, like, what happened? And then there's like, we don't talk about it. And the whole
Ugh.
family has never spoken about it to this day.
That's horrifying, and I would. It, I think if my parents did that to me, I would probably be plotting my revenge, honestly. I like to think that I'm forgiving, but something like that, I'd be like, oh no, you are gonna get yours someday.
Yeah, I agree. But yeah, that's my spring break. Relaxation and binge watching Netflix while working on a project.
Exciting. Okay. And then I'm in earlier you said for me to remind you about something to do with cruise ships.
Yes.
What is this? I'm intrigued because I've had a lot of friends who have been going on cruises a lot lately. I'm hoping this is not some horrible news about.
No, it's not horrible. It's just something that I learned, and then like in retrospect, I'm not surprised, but I just never thought about this before. So, an average cruise lasts about a week. On a 1 week cruise, on average, three people will die. So
Whoa.
every cruise ship down at the very, very bottom, like as far away from guests as there can be, there is a morgue where they keep the dead bodies. However, most morgues only hold up to at most five people. So if you are ever on a cruise ship and all of a sudden it's free ice cream, unlimited for everyone. Doesn't matter how much ice cream you have, they're just giving out free ice cream all day long. That means someone more than the ship's capacity to hold died, and ice cream is one of the cheapest items in their freezer that they have an actual separate freezer for, just for ice cream. So that person who went over the limit is now being stored in the ice cream freezer.
No, that is just insane.
I know. I was like, this can't be real. But then I was listening to NPR. It was on NPR, and they started saying like, this has been verified by XYZ cruise lines. This is a true thing that happens. If there's ever free ice cream, that means someone extra just died.
Someone died. Someone beyond the like suspected number of deaths died.
Yep.
That is crazy. And also like so alarming that like we'll just put him in the ice cream freezer.
I mean,
You
what
know,
else are they
where
supposed to do?
right. I mean, yeah,
You
you
can't
gotta do
throw them
something with.
overboard. You can't stack them on top of someone else. That's just not nice.
Yeah, and I imagine it's, I mean, especially because I'm sure there's plenty of cruises that like that doesn't happen, so it's kind of just a precaution
Yeah.
because it's just like a numbers game that like eventually someone will die, especially 'cause old people seem to really like cruises.
Yeah, or there's a lot of alcohol involved in cruises. Accidents happen.
Oh yeah. I mean, plus when you've got hundreds and hundreds of people together for any extended period of time, just naturally something's gonna happen to somebody. But man, oh, that is just it's also, I just imagine like whoever was traveling with that person that died, they're really sad that their travel companion is dead, but then they're happy that they have free ice cream.
Or do they feel the wrong way about it? It's like my partner just died and the cruise ship is throwing a party. It's like,
Or will this forever ruin ice cream for me because it will always make me think of the death of this person?
yeah, that's true.
Wow, where did you find
I mean, I was listening to it as I was getting ready in the morning. It was just
Okay, so it
a,
was.
it just came on.
Wow. Oh man, that is fascinating. I have never taken a cruise before, but maybe if I ever do, I'll be like, just in case, where's the morgue? Or where's
Apparently, it's
the.
like at the bottom of the ship.
It makes sense. I mean, you don't want to waste some like primo like deck space for.
Or have the public get access to it.
Yeah. You don't want to waste the views on someone who can't enjoy them anymore.
Oh.
Oh, we are getting our morbid sense of humor is showing.
Yes, very much.
Well, should we go ahead and get started? Is there any other business you wanted to attend to?
Nope, not that I can think of.
Okay. Well, if you're ready, I'm ready.
Okay.
Okay, so before we dig into today's main topic, I thought I would pose a question to you first. So I'm wondering if you, Patrick, have ever witnessed a dangerous situation or a crime.
Yes.
Ooh, okay. And this also could apply to like maybe like a medical emergency. So what sort of example do you have? Or do you have too many to count?
Oh, I mean, I've seen some very brutal car accidents.
Ooh, okay, that would be a great example.
I have witnessed a man physically assaulting his female partner, which was very unpleasant to watch. I've seen at the county fair where I grew up, I've seen a shotgun get pulled on someone.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah, it was an
Who knew the
argument
county
that got
fair
me.
was such a dangerous spot?
Well, you get a bunch of country folk with guns on the back of their trucks and throw a little beer in it, say something that offends somebody, and things get elevated pretty quick. I'm sure I've seen others. I have seen one that
So,
I'm not going to mention.
okay. Well, this is gives us plenty to talk about
Okay.
here. So,
Okay.
did you personally intervene in any of these situations?
I called 911 on the accident. The man assaulting his female partner was actually to my two door down neighbor, who I heard her screaming from inside my apartment, and I ran over to see what was happening, and he only stopped because I showed up. Shotgun incident,
Yeah, when guns
no.
are involved, that's when you don't want to put your own ri life at risk to like intervene in a situation. But th I think that that's really impressive that you kind of jumped into action in some of those situations. Because this actually came up in conversation. I was hanging out with a couple of friends just recently. And somewhere in the conversation, we discussed the strange phenomena that sometimes occurs during high stress situations when we seemingly forget how we're supposed to behave during an emergency. So it's not unheard of for people to ignore an individual in crisis because they assume that someone else has already called for help, especially if there are many people around. And so this is called the bystander effect. So Psychology Today says that the bystander effect occurs when the presence of others discourages an individual from intervening in an emergency situation against a bully or during an assault or other crime. The greater the number of bystanders, the less likely it is for any one of them to provide help to the person in distress, which I think is like, whoa, that kind of makes perfect
It
sense to me.
does. I actually, when I was in college, I took a sociology class, and this was actually one of my favorite lectures when we talked about this. And I'm kind of hoping you're going to talk about a case that we studied. I'll
Ooh.
see if you do. It's fucking disturbing what happened in that case. I'll let you reveal your story first. But if it's what I'm thinking of, it's messed up.
Oh yeah. And it what and actually here in this for the description that it will mention a couple of cases. So I wouldn't be surprised if one of these that I even just touch on
Okay.
might be one of them. So interestingly enough, The fewer the witnesses, the greater the likelihood of someone intervening and helping out. So the bystander effect was popularized as a concept following the brutal murder of Kitty Genovese in 1964. So Kitty was stabbed to death outside her New York City apartment, despite the fact that dozens of neighbors were close by and no one stepped in or called the police.
Yep, this is the one.
So that is one that is kind of the initial case that really sparked the social scientists who were kind of studying this phenomenon pointed to this as one of their early examples. So the social scientists that coined this theory attributed it to two factors. One is the diffusion of responsibility, which means that the more witnesses, the bigger the crowd of people, the less personal responsibility each individual felt to take action. And then the other component is social influence, which means that individuals model the behavior to those around them. So like when you're in a crowd, like chances are you're probably indirectly or directly modeling how you're acting on how everybody else around you is acting. So we're looking at others to determine their personal actions. So just kind of to sum it up, if no one else seems to think that what is happening is a big deal, you're much more likely to just go about minding your own business, because if there's really something wrong, somebody else would probably already be taking care of it. So it kind of is like, oh, we're all just a bunch of lemmings here. We just are following the crowd. This makes me think of an interesting situation. A few years back, I was at the Minnesota State Fair, and this is like the first time that I can recall where there was any kind of like gun-related thing happened at the state fair, because usually the state fair is like really well protected. I mean, there's law enforcement everywhere. Everything's pretty like locked down. And you have to go through metal detectors and stuff when you're going in, so you think that there's no chance. But a gun went off. Like, no one got hurt, but because a gun went off and there was a huge crowd of people, there was just like a stampede. And let me tell you, one of the scariest things, like, it's just very eerie when you see a mass of people all running in one direction, and your first thought is, whatever they're running away from, I should be running away from it too. But it's interesting, because I was with a small group of friends at the time, and I think I can recall myself being like, you guys think we should run with them, or like run in the same direction? And one of my good friends, very level-headedly, was like, let's just stay put. Like, we don't want to just be part of the herd. Like, let's just stay put for the moment. And of course, everything ended up being okay. Like, that crowd ran by, things got really eerie and quiet for a moment. But then when it was clear that there wasn't any danger, everything just went back to normal. It was a very strange situation. So in today's society, where everyone seemingly has a camera in their pocket, it's really hard to imagine a time when serious and obvious crimes could go unchecked by everyday citizens. But today's case, which came up in that same conversation that I was talking about when we were talking about the bystander effect, is a shocking reminder that the bystander effect can have chilling consequences. So I know you are thrilled and excited to find out what this
I
case is.
am because I'm very fascinated by the bystander effect. I've
Yes.
always been interested in it.
So it was a Tuesday afternoon, November 16th, 1971, and motorists in the Rochester, New York area were headed home from work on Interstate 490. It should have been a typical afternoon rush hour, but the traffic was interrupted by a horrific sight. Along the side of the highway, a young girl, 10-year-old Carmen Colon, was naked from the waist down and attempting to flee from a man in a vehicle believed to be a dark-colored Ford Pinto hatchback that was pursuing her while driving in reverse. Carmen waved her arms as she attempted to flag down a passing motorist, anyone who could possibly save her from the man in the car who was closing in on her. Nearly 100 drivers are estimated to have passed this horrific scene on the side of the road, and yet no one stopped. No one even pulled off at the next exit to use a payphone. Now, remember, we're in the 70s here, and there aren't cell phones. And one witness later said that they witnessed Carmen being escorted back into the car by her abductor. Sadly, this is the last time that the young girl was seen alive. 2 days later, her body was found in a gully near the village of Churchville, 12 miles from where she had last been seen on the side of the road. She was the first victim of what would become known as the Alphabet Murders,
Oh,
also
I.
known as the Double Initial Murders.
Yes, I know this. I don't know it well, though. Like, I know the name, but I don't really know too much about it.
This is one of those things where the friend of mine who was kind of relaying this story to me had part of the story. And I'm like, oh, this is just too weird. Like, I have to find out more. So it's a really sad story. I mean, like most of our stories, but it is really important, I think. And I think we can all learn something really crucial from this. And yeah, we'll just continue on here. So 10-year-old Carmen came from a Puerto Rican family. New York State for decades had been a land of opportunity for Puerto Rican families looking for a fresh start in the mainland United States. In fact, New York City has the largest Puerto Rican community outside of the island itself. But the Colon family, their American dream turned into a nightmare the day their daughter was mercilessly plucked away from them. Carmen had lovely dark eyes, shoulder-length brown hair, and a winning smile. One podcast that I listened to described her as a childlike Karen Carpenter, which I think is absolutely spot on. So, like, if I'm sure we'll probably post pictures of
Yes.
the children in today's case, and that was like the perfect description of her. She just looks so sweet. Now, Carmen struggled a bit with her English proficiency and was enrolled in special education classes. But other than that, she seemed to be a pretty normal suburban kid. And being a typical kid of that era, she was sometimes entrusted with errands for her family. On the afternoon when she disappeared, she was sent to the drugstore to pick up a prescription for her grandmother. And it seems like this is something that was kind of like an average, like normal thing. Although it seemed that most of the time when she went to the pharmacy, she was accompanied by an adult. But this time she was allowed to go by herself, which is really something that will be kind of a theme today is we've got children of a certain age where they're starting to be like old enough to have a little bit of independence. And it seems like they want to be trusted to go out on their own and do something like within reason, you know,
Right.
do some things on their own because, you know, they want to grow up. They want to be treated like, you know, maybe like their older siblings or like little adults, you know, that they just like they are kind of mimicking the day-to-day things that their parents do. Like, yeah, mom goes to the pharmacy or goes to the grocery store. And
Yeah.
I need to learn how to do that myself. Or I've seen her do that enough. I could do that. So there's like this little bit of independence, and it's just so sad that this is kind of the beginning of where things go wrong. So the pharmacy was only a couple of blocks away from home, so it seemed safe to allow her to roam within the neighborhood that she was so familiar with. In fact, the owner of the pharmacy, or the manager of the pharmacy, like knew her on a first name basis. It's like
Okay.
this is the kind of place where you know the families of the people who come into your drugstore and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So you know your regulars. So she made it to the pharmacy just fine and waited for the prescription to be filled outside of the store. And now the store owner, Jack Corbin, however, informed Carmen that the prescription she had been sent to collect had not been processed and would be delayed. So Carmen is quoted as saying, "I gotta go, I gotta go," upon hearing this, and she quickly exited the store. So it seems kind of almost like a nervous or like a pressured response.
Yeah, I
It
wonder why.
and that's what it what makes me wonder too. Why was she all of a sudden so gung-ho to like get out of there? So after she left, she was then witnessed entering a car parked nearby that appeared to have been waiting for her. Just shy of an hour later, that is when the highway scene played out. So we're talking about, middle of the afternoon during the time when lots of people are coming home from work, going back home, maybe coming home from the grocery store with their dinner, all these typical outings that happen in the middle of the day, and lots of people going by, and nobody stops.
Wow. And you said she wasn't wearing clothing?
She was naked from the waist down, which that should have just been like.
I mean, if you see any child outside without, anything covering their lower region, like my initial reaction would be like to stop and throw that extra jacket I keep in the back seat around them.
Right? It is bizarre. And I can't imagine like the mental gymnastics you would have to do to be
Like, should I help that girl? No, I'll keep driving.
yeah, it does seem very, very strange.
Wow. And
So
but also, I mean, like, I feel not that this is right in any way, shape, or form, but I also feel like maybe the thought process crossed people's mind of like, oh, that's some kid that's thrown a tantrum,
that's where my mind
and the
went.
car's trying to, get them to come back, get back in the car, calm down. Get like a lecturing, like maybe that thought crossed people's minds too.
I
Definitely not everybody's, but I'm sure
right.
some.
I definitely think that must have been something that crossed at least some of those people's minds. And also maybe that also points to that nobody probably could have even imagined what was really going on.
Yeah. Yeah.
That some like child murderer was about to claim his victim. That was probably the furthest thing from anybody's mind,
Yeah.
which maybe that is maybe that's a good thing that people felt safe and comfortable in their community. But it's sort of that I wish people were maybe just a little more curious, a little more cautious.
Yeah, I completely agree.
So night fell, and Carmen had still not returned from her errand. and she was officially reported missing at 7:50 p.m. Police scoured the neighborhood but came up empty-handed. 2 days passed before two teenage boys in the small nearby town of Churchville discovered Carmen's body while riding bikes. They first thought that the young girl was a half-clothed mannequin, but on closer inspection, they realized the horror that they had come upon. Her coat was found 300 feet away from her body in a culvert, and her pants were found near that spot on I-490 where she had been coerced back into the car. So, which is just so weird, like that her pants were left on the side of the road. It's
Yeah.
like that's the like moment where I'd be like, oh God, what is going to happen next? So the autopsy for Carmen revealed extensive fingernail scratch marks all over her body, fractures in her skull and in one of her vertebrae, and most horrifically, signs of sexual assault. Her cause of death was strangulation. Now, when the news of Carmen's death broke, reports came in about the roadside incident that was witnessed by many. Again and again, the police asked, why didn't you stop? Some said they were going too fast to stop. Others were in a hurry to get home. Pol the police captain, I think it's Sparacino. I know there's a lot of difficult Italian names in this part of the country. So
Well, I
I'm
just
going
went to Italy. I'm an expert.
to say, okay. I'm going to say Sparacino.
Sparacino.
Yeah. Oh, I could go for a Sparacino. I think he summed it up best when he said, how fast is too fast to save a helpless child's life?
Yep,
And that
exactly.
is really, it boils it down
Or like, what is so
perfectly.
important to get home to?
Right. Like, is your favorite show going to be on soon? Be like, not worth it. There'll be reruns. Don't worry. Yeah, that if you see a child in distress, check on them. Even if it ends up being a totally mundane situation, it's better to just err on the side
Yep,
of
I
checking.
agree.
So the search for Carmen's killer carried on, but no one was able to provide any substantial leads. Billboards went up with a bold question, do you know who killed Carmen Colon? Splashed across the signs, accompanied by Carmen's school picture. There was also a $6,000 reward offered for information leading to some solid answers as to who committed this heinous act. And that is approximately $45,000 in today's money, which is just crazy to think of how much like
Yeah, I was thinking, I was like, what?
the inflation has gone up over the last 50 years. The community was shaken, but no one could have imagined that just 17 months later, the killer would strike again and reignite the cycle of tragedy. So, with the investigation stalled into Carmen's death, it was extra heartbreaking when another little girl, this time 11-year-old Wanda Walkowitz, was abducted just 3 blocks from her home in the East Rochester area on April 2nd, 1973. Once again, this was a situation when a child had been sent out on an errand close to home and had been intercepted by a kidnapper. At around 5 p.m. the day she disappeared, Wanda was headed to a neighborhood deli to pick up a few groceries for her mother. The little happy-go-lucky redhead quickly gathered the items that were requested, and about 15 minutes later, she was back, or she was on her way back home. And for like the tiniest little shred of levity, I do think it's amusing that one of the items she was sent to the store to pick up was cigarettes. I like
Yeah,
apparently Back then, like, you could just send your, 11-year-old child to go pick up
I mean, they
cigarettes.
also sent a little girl to go pick up prescription medication. I mean,
Right, where now it's like you have to have your ID and you have to have the date of birth for
right.
the person who the prescription is for. Like, it's a much simpler time. Yeah, I literally wrote different times, man, different times.
Yeah.
And if you're at all interested what the rest of the list consisted of, it was it included milk, bread, and diapers. So, pretty typical everyday household items. So it was reported by the store's clerk that she came in and left by herself and did not appear to be followed. On her way home, another witness noticed that the young girl seemed to be struggling to carry her groceries as she walked down the street, which, again, if only some like nice responsible person had stepped in to help her, like this might not have ever happened. Like if an actual good Samaritan was like, here, I'll like carry the heavy milk for you or something. I don't know. Now this same witness noticed a large brown car driving alongside her. And when they looked again, Wanda was already in the vehicle. So it sounds like it happened really, really quick.
And I imagine the
So,
driver saw that she was struggling and was like, "Hey, I can help you get those home easier. You want a
and
ride?"
it makes me wonder, like, oh, was this somebody that she recognized? Was it somebody from her neighborhood that maybe she wouldn't have questioned? Be like, oh, that's a familiar face. I can go with them.
Yeah.
After Wanda had vanished, those that knew her were shocked to think that she would have gotten into a car with a stranger. Her teacher, Joseph Hillman, is quoted as saying, "I don't think she was the kind of girl to get into the car with a stranger. I think she's much too bright for this." Wanda was a bright young girl who might not have fallen for a typical kidnapper's rhetoric. Which led some to speculate that perhaps she knew the person who abducted her well enough to get into the car with them. At 8 p.m. that evening, Wanda's mother, Joyce, reported her daughter missing. The memory of Carmen's abduction and murder was still fresh in her and the community's memory, and I'm sure she prayed that history would not repeat itself. Dozens of detectives searched the area, including around the Genesee River, where she was known to play, but they failed to locate Wanda. Little did they know, their worst fears were coming true. At around 10:15 the following morning, a police officer found Wanda's body 7 miles from Rochester on an access road to State Route 104 in the town of Webster. Unlike Carmen, Wanda was found fully clothed, but an autopsy revealed that she too had been sexually assaulted and then redressed after her death. Further adding to the indignity, it appeared that her body had been thrown from a moving vehicle as if she had been some kind of disposable piece of trash rather than a human child with a family and a future. The autopsy, though, revealed more about the attack, including Wanda's grit and determination. She had defensive wounds, which meant that she fought back against her attacker. Also, perhaps it could be said that her attacker was forced to change his tactics because of her tenacity. Where Carmen had been strangled by hand, Wanda was likely strangled from behind using what is believed to be a belt. The final clue that was revealed from the autopsy was the presence of white cat hairs. Wanda's family didn't own a cat, so
Okay.
the hair could only have come from the killer. Once again, the community was devastated and fearful. Flyers were distributed by the hundreds. A tip line was created, and now a $10,000 reward was promised if it meant that this sick killer could be taken off the streets of Rochester. The tip line produced two different vehicle descriptions. One was that large brown vehicle that was mentioned earlier, and the other described a young red-headed girl being forced into a light-colored Dodge Dart. Unfortunately, these did not lead to any certainty in the investigation. In fact, the Rochester Police Department did not initially connect the murders of Carmen and Wanda because technically the methods of murder were different. When questioned publicly, the police department dismissed the idea that the two child murders were related. Unfortunately, it would take one more child's disappearance until the dots were finally connected.
It always does. Like they never, which I get, they need more of like a repeated pattern. And especially you said this is more than a year later.
Yes, so I think it was 17 months,
Yeah,
which
so like
is,
the MO's
like, I
the
have to do the math
same.
in my head.
Yeah, the MO's the same, you know, find a little girl by herself, strangulation, sexual assault. But unfortunately, we both know that there are more than one person in this world that wants to do that. So
Exactly.
I get why they always need like just one more to really tie all these together.
Right. And when we look at all the coincidences, it's like if you see like a couple of similarities, like that can be chalked up to coincidence. But then when you start seeing like a bunch of things line up, it's really hard to believe that all of this just happened to be like complete happenstance.
Yeah. I can say like the one outlier in Wanda's from Carmen's is the fact that she was redressed, whereas
Right.
Carmen was
Whereas
not.
Carmen was left half clothed.
And Carmen also was, I guess you could say, hidden a little bit better. She was down in a culvert, whereas Wanda was just like on the side of the road, basically.
Kind of on the side of the road. So I'm sure that all these factors are taken into consideration by law enforcement to see if they really are committed by the same person. Now, 7 months later, Wanda's case had still not been resolved, and the 2 year anniversary of Carmen's murder had passed without any kind of resolution either. And on November 26th, 1973, a third and final victim was added to the list. 11-year-old Michelle Mainza. I was like, okay, I'm gonna nail this, and then I don't know if I got it right. I'm gonna say Mainza.
Is it Menza?
It's Maenza. It's a tricky one.
It's either Menza or like Mayenza, like
Maenza.
Hispanic Latin.
I like the sound of Maenza. We're gonna go with that, Maenza. If anybody wants to correct me on that, I am all ears because
Yes, please do let us know.
names are hard sometimes.
Yes.
So 11-year-old Michelle had already had a hard time at school where she dealt with bullies on a regular basis. Her rounded cheeks and kind of offset eyes, which I think adults would find endearing, made her a prime target on the playground because she looked different.
Yeah.
But despite the cruelty that she endured, she had a good heart. That afternoon, her mother had misplaced her purse while shopping at a shopping plaza that was near Michelle's school. Michelle, being the thoughtful young girl that she was, intended to return to the shopping center to search for her mother's missing purse after school. Classmates noticed her cross the street headed for the shopping plaza around 3:20 p.m. by herself. And that is the last time Michelle was seen alive ever again. To add to the sting of her disappearance, this was the first time that she was allowed to leave school and walk by herself. And even her uncle had noticed the girl. He had been driving by, and he was in his car. He noticed Michelle was walking by herself and offered her a ride, but Michelle declined. So I'm imagining, like, he'd be like, "Oh, hey, like, I can give you a, like, you don't have to walk. I can give you a ride." And she probably was like, "No, this is me. I get to have a big girl moment. Like, all the older girls get to walk home by themselves. Like, this is my opportunity to show my beginning levels of maturity." And then, unfortunately, this is some, someone was watching, and somebody just jumped at the opportunity. Now, there were so many what ifs to be considered. What if the purse had not been left at the store? What if she hadn't been allowed to walk home alone? What if her uncle had insisted harder on giving her a ride? These questions would haunt everyone involved.
I was gonna say, I can't imagine the amount of guilt that her mother felt, even
Oh
though
my
it is not
gosh.
at all her fault.
Exactly. I mean, there is no way that you could have ever foreseen something like this. And it's strange to think, but like, even though there were these two high-profile murders of children, life still went on. You know, errands still needed to be done. Kids had to find their way home from school. Children still played in their neighborhoods. So it's not like you could all of a sudden just put a lock on every child in the entire city. It's just, life still had to go on. And it's just unfortunate that someone was there waiting in the shadows to find that perfect opportunity to snatch the next young girl. So at around 3:30 p.m. on the day of Michelle's abduction, witnesses spotted a large beige or tan vehicle driving suspiciously fast down Ackerman Street near the last place that she had been seen. The vehicle was driving so erratically that one witness said it nearly collided with another car. Inside, a crying little girl could be spotted. Later in the afternoon, around 5:30 p.m., a vehicle matching that same description was spotted on the side of Route 350 near Walworth with a flat tire. A Good Samaritan stopped and offered to help the driver with the flat, but was met with unusual aggression. The man fixing the flat had an uncomfortably tight grip on the little girl that was with him. He obscured the license plate and he took on an intimidating posture. Because of this, the Good Samaritan driver felt compelled to leave right away. So this is just so weird that, somebody who was nice enough, because I mean, as we already saw, like, if people weren't going to stop for a little girl in distress, what makes you think that they were going to stop for somebody who just has a flat tire? But I suppose a flat tire is a far more common occurrence that people would be like, "Oh, I know how to change a flat. Like, let me just see if this person needs some help." But then to be met with open hostility when you try to help someone, and this picture in my mind is just, there's all sorts of red flags. Like, why does he have to be holding on to the little girl while he's changing the flat tire? And they particularly described that it was like an iron grip. Why does it seem like he's purposefully obscuring the license plate? I feel like those are little things that you pick up on right away and should be like, okay, red flag, what's going on here?
Yeah, totally. And I
But
can
at this
understand why the Good Samaritan didn't feel comfortable, further investigating the situation, because me, myself being a smaller person, like if it was, like a 6 foot, like 200 pound man, I'd want to ask, like, hey, little girl, are you okay? But at the same time, like, I would be pulverized. Like, I
And
mean,
that was the next thing I was gonna say is that when somebody is, especially if they have an intimidating posture or body size or whatever the case might be, yeah, if someone is like, no, I got it, like in a really aggressive way, yeah, I would definitely be in the camp of being like, well, geez, I'm sorry I asked. I guess I hope your flat gets fixed. I'm gonna go. It is hard to put yourself in a position where to be more curious when you think like, oh, maybe my safety could be at risk here
yeah.
if I press further. So 2 days later, on November 28th, 1973, the Walworth fire chief discovered Michelle's body face down in a ditch off Eddy Road in Mayston, New York. Once again, just like with Wanda, Michelle was found fully clothed, but it was revealed that she had been sexually assaulted. The method of murder was found to be the same, though this time, a rope was suspected, and the presence of that same white cat hair was also discovered on the body.
Okay.
So, at the very, very least, like Wanda and Michelle are almost caught, like copy paste,
Yeah.
like method and everything. So, we're pretty sure we are dealing with a serial killer here. Upon examining the contents of her stomach, Michelle's last meal of a hamburger with onions corroborated a sighting at Carol's Restaurant in Penfield, New York, on the 26th. A description of the suspect was put together, and he was described as a dark, shaggy-haired Caucasian, between the ages of 25 and 35. At the sighting, he wore a dark-colored ski-type vest and jeans that were tucked into brown cowboy boots with buckles on the sides. His beard was short, but his fingernails were noted to be long and dirty. The restaurant description also matched the description of the man changing the tire on the side of the road.
Okay.
So it's like, okay, it sounds like we're dealing with one person here and
Yeah.
not because I think sometimes people get away with stuff when there's more than one person, because then you can have somebody else cover for be like, oh, well, I couldn't have abducted them because I was over here at the time and everyone saw me there.
Yeah.
But then it turns out that there's somebody else involved who actually did the abducting or something like that. So it is encouraging that, like, okay, we are closing in on a more defined description of the person, and that we are likely dealing with just a single man. Now, with a solid description of the suspect out in the public, there was a glimmer of hope that someone knew who this man was and that he could be located. When the police were pressed on whether the same person could be responsible for Carmen and Wanda's murders, they responded that they were not completely convinced, but they were strongly suspicious that it could be the same person. But the circumstances of their deaths would not be the only similarity that would link the three cases together. So, if you've been following along with the names, you will notice that each victim's first and last name start with the same letter, which is why you'll sometimes hear this case referred to as the double initial murders. This common thread shared between all three girls seems unlikely to be a coincidence if the killer was killing based on opportunity. Like, what would the odds be of just like three young girls, like same kind of profile, that happen to have double initial, like
Right.
initials that are the same? That I feel like the odds are extremely, extremely slim.
Yeah, and that might also explain why there's gaps in between, like such long breaks in between, because the killer needs to find
Yeah.
victims with double letters.
Yes, that would also make sense to me. But why these girls? Why these letters and in this order? The girls were even found near towns that also corresponded to the letters of their names. So we've got Churchville for Carmen, Webster for Wanda, and Mayston for Michelle. And some have even theorized that CWM might stand for the killer's invitation to the girls, come with me, which just
Ooh, that's
really gives me.
creepy.
That
That's
gives me the
very
creeps
creepy.
thinking about it. When I heard that theory posed, I was like, that is taking it to a new level. But if this killer truly chose his victims based on their names, how did he know that information about them? And how did he know where to find them? And when they would be vulnerable and alone. Did these girls have some kind of knowledge of their attacker enough to feel comfortable to get in the car with him? The double letters and the age of the girls are just the beginning of the similarities for the three. They came from poor Catholic families, from the poorer part of Rochester. And they all had various struggles at school, either academically or socially. This makes me and others wonder if the perpetrator might have had some kind of connection to the school system, like a social worker or other employee, or even a connection to the Catholic Church. Both situations would allow for an adult to glean some of this intimate information without drawing suspicion. Even with this information, though, it was hard to find suspects that might fit, but some did emerge over the years. First, there was Miguel Colon, and he was suspected of only Carmen's murder. There were just enough differences about Carmen's murder that it could have been separate from the other two cases. Miguel was Carmen's uncle on her father's side. When Carmen's parents split up, Miguel became very close to her mother, Guillermina. And his closeness to the family would have allowed him access to the routines of the family, and it would have been easy for him to find out when Carmen would be alone.
Yeah.
In addition, the dark-colored Ford Pinto spotted on I-490 was strikingly similar to a car Miguel had purchased only a few weeks before. When authorities searched the car, they found that it had been recently extensively cleaned inside and out, and even the trunk had been cleaned with a strong cleaning solution, which is very suspicious because, like, okay, you get a new car and I wasn't quite sure if this was like a new used car or something, but apparently the investigators had talked to the people at the car dealership about, like, hey, is it like standard practice to clean the trunks of the car? And they were like, no, that's not something that we do. So that cleaning that happened with the trunk of the car had happened since Miguel had purchased the car. One thing that was found in the car, though, was one of Carmen's dolls. Now, it is possible that the doll had been left during a previous car trip, but considering the circumstances, it didn't look good.
Yeah,
Just
but
for...
why clean the car so extensively but not get rid of the doll?
Right. And that would it seem like an odd thing that you'd think you'd want to just get rid of any evidence that anybody had ever been in the car,
Yeah.
just to be safe. To further add to the guilty column for Miguel, just 4 days after his niece's death, he fled the country and returned to Puerto Rico. A close friend of his was informed just days before he left that he had to leave because he had, quote, done something wrong in Rochester, end quote. So this could be an admission of guilt, or it could be that he was afraid of being nailed for a crime that he didn't commit. Although, if he was just talking to someone who is like a close friend and a confidant, it doesn't seem that he would kind of phrase it this way, that he had done something wrong.
Yeah.
If he was, you know, if he was trying to present that he might be accused of a crime he didn't commit. It just sounds like it sounds a little bit too much like an admission of guilt.
Yeah, it does. And to be honest, like these facts, I think definitely make him a good candidate for Carmen's murder. Like maybe she's not connected to the other two, which would be odd given like the alphabet aspect. But he's definitely a top candidate for Carmen.
I agree. So yeah, this phrasing just seems to point more toward him admitting his guilt in doing something very, very bad. In March of 1972, investigators actually pursued Miguel to San Juan, but word got to him first that they were coming, and he evaded authorities. But after extensive searching, he was finally located on March 26th, 1972, and extradited back to Rochester for questioning. When asked about his whereabouts during his niece's murder, he was unable to corroborate an alibi. But there wasn't any physical evidence to link him to the murder itself.
Right.
You know, if it all happened in the car and that car was cleaned so thoroughly and there wasn't any physical things there that to link him to the murder, that's like a prosecutor's worst nightmare. Like all we have are these dots here and there, and we don't have that crucial bit of evidence to link all these dots together.
Right.
Now, because a lack of an alibi isn't enough to convict someone of a crime, he was allowed to walk free. But Miguel certainly didn't live happily ever after. In 1991, he took his own life after shooting his wife and brother during a domestic dispute.
Wow.
Any hope of answers from him are now lost forever. Which is so weird because he, like, it's from what it sounded like, is that he married his brother's ex. So, and this is the same brother who was the father of
Oh,
Carmen.
wow.
And it's just
Wow.
like, oh my gosh, this is like soap opera level of family
Yeah,
drama.
that is. They must have really, she must have really believed that he was innocent.
Right, you would have to if to have any sort of relationship with him. But I assume they probably were thinking like, oh, there's some unknown person out there who's responsible for all three.
That's true.
Also, it is worth noting that I do believe that the wife and the brother did survive that shooting.
Oh, good. I was
So
wondering.
it, which is just, wow, how do you bounce back from that with, it's like you've already had a bunch of trauma in your life, losing a daughter, and then now you are dealing with this very strange other loss.
Yeah.
So another suspect of the Alphabet murders was a 25-year-old Rochester firefighter named Dennis Termini. On January 1st, 1974, he attempted to abduct a teenage girl at gunpoint. The girl began screaming despite the man's threats, and the commotion was enough to scare the would-be kidnapper away. So there we go. Scream loud. Make sure that anybody who's trying to abduct you gets freaked out.
Yep.
Stupidly, he tried again after his failed attempt, this time resulting in the pursuit by law enforcement. So apparently, like, this happened like right in front of officers, and they were able to like intervene and pursue him. So Termini almost evaded capture, but was soon cornered with no other place to go. When he saw that the jig was up, and that he had no other options, he turned the gun on himself and took his own life. In the wake of his suicide, it was discovered that he was responsible for a rash of sexual assaults of teenage girls and young women in the area between 1971 and 1973. But a man who targets teenagers and young women doesn't seem like the same kind of guy who would target young girls, though,
That's
right?
what I was thinking.
Well, some other bits of evidence lined up with him as well. He owned a beige vehicle that was similar to the one spotted by witnesses at the abduction sites. He lived less than 3 miles from the final victim, and when police searched his car, there was a map marked with the location of where Michelle's body had been discovered.
Oh.
He also owned a white cat, which would explain the fur that was found on Wanda and Michelle.
Yes.
And anyone who owns a white furry pet of any sort, you know that those little hairs are stuck with you for the rest of your life. So they're just never going away. Finally, a reasonable reason why these children might have trusted Termini would be because of his position as a firefighter.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
So if he had any kind of his gear on display, it might put his victims at ease knowing that they were in the presence of a trusted public servant like a firefighter. So all of this seems to make a pretty strong case for Termini as the one responsible, not to mention the fact that the killing stopped after he took his own life. But in 2007, DNA was posthumously taken from his body and compared with the semen samples found on Wanda's body, and the DNA was not a match. The same test could not be run for the other girls due to lack of evidence. So, but I always think that this is so fascinating when cases, especially from this era, like the 70s, where they actually do take samples of the D of DNA left at a crime scene, like a sexual assault, knowing that at the time they did not have the technology to do like a DNA test. But the fact that, like, well, if in the future they, which we are now able to do, we at least have something we can compare it with and hopefully clear these cold cases. So, two other high-profile serial killers would also be suspected of the string of murders. Kenneth Bianacci, which is one of the Hillside Stranglers, which occurred in the Los Angeles area with the help of his cousin Angelo Buono. In the early 1970s, Bianacci lived in Rochester, New York, where he worked as an ice cream vendor and worked in the area near some of the crime scenes attributed to the Alphabet murders. Also, I imagine what profession would a child trust more than an ice cream salesman?
Yes, that's true.
So he too had a car that matched the description witnesses gave. Although at this point, I'm starting to wonder if just about everyone had a tan or beige
Well,
car
that's
back
what I was
then.
thinking because it was the 70s. Everything was brown, olive green, or orange. Like,
Right. We really had a certain sense of style back then.
yeah, so I'm not surprised that there are so many beige cars.
Right. Unfortunately, it did not age well. But then beyond that, the similarities just look a lot more like coincidence. The other killer that had been suspected was convicted murderer Joseph Nasso. And he was convicted in August of 2013 of California's own alphabet murders that occurred between 1977 and 1994.
Okay.
Once again, all of the victims had first and last names that started with the same letters. His victims were adults, though, and ranged from age 18 to 38 years old, which doesn't seem to fit the victim type when it comes to the Rochester case. When he was asked about the double letters, Nasso said that it had no meaning and the double initial thing is just a coincidence, he said. Nasso's DNA was also compared to the semen sample from Wanda's murder, and once again, it was not a match. With that, the suspect pool appears to be exhausted. 50 years have passed since the murder of Michelle, the last official victim of the alphabet murders. With so many years gone since the crimes, the window of opportunity to find answers grows smaller with each passing year. In all likelihood, the perpetrator is likely dead, imprisoned on other charges, or has moved from the area. But hope, no matter how small, still remains, and the Rochester Police Department has not given up on investigating these heinous crimes. News articles published in 2009 renewed interest in the cases and reinvigorated the search, though that crucial clue to crack the case has not come yet. If you or anyone you know has information that could be helpful to solving this case, the Rochester police ask that you call them at 585-428-6720. Which we can put that phone number in the show notes.
Yes.
Someone out there knows something, and it could bring closure to the families of these girls and bring a small amount of peace. So that is the story of the alphabet murders out of Rochester, New York.
Yeah, well, great job telling the story. Thank you for sharing it with me because again, like I had heard of it, but maybe I also had heard of the one from Nassau in California. Who knows which one I'd heard of, but I never fully investigated it. To me, all the suspects, the two serial killers, don't make sense to me. I don't think it was them.
Right. I think that their victim type was older.
For Carmen, I am like 85% convinced it was her uncle, and maybe it was just coincidence with the alphabet thing. The other two, I do feel like the fireman is a great candidate despite the DNA not matching because science is not always perfect. Did they retest and retest and retest? Did they do it multiple times or was it just like a one and they're like, okay, it's not him.
Yeah, and it does make me wonder what kind of certainty, like what level of certainty they have.
Yeah.
I imagine they would probably have to be pretty certain to, I mean, you're testing a dead man, so it would be a very convenient person to pin it on
Yeah.
if indeed there was any kind of certainty. And that would just bring a lot of closure, I think. So I would imagine that they wouldn't take that lightly.
Yeah, but
There's got to be someone out there. There is a really great picture of the like an artist mock-up of the suspect, based on like that description from like the diner and the changing the tire. And it's like, oh, that looks so distinct. But then I'm like, that also could look like so many people back then,
Yeah, I was
because
looking
like
at photos
the
as you were going
shaggy kind of
along.
look, yeah,
And I was
was
like, this looks like any guy in the 70s.
like
Any
that.
white man in America in the 70s, this is him.
Yeah, like there were definitely some things like, yeah, my dad had that same beard probably in the 70s, you know.
Yeah, but yeah, to be honest, I got a little angry while you're telling it. Like, violence against children really, really pisses me off.
Oh,
And
absolutely. Yeah, this whole time researching this case, like I felt fired up about
yeah.
this, like, come on, there's got to be someone out there who knows something, who
Yeah.
just hasn't said it yet.
But yeah, and then also just like we all know my great low tolerance towards any type of sexual assault. And sexual assault on children just like really, really pisses me off.
Yep, if anybody has been listening to our podcast for a long time, we know children and animals, like I think if you want to get us really, really upset over a crime, either one of those topics, because both of those groups are pretty defenseless.
But yeah, regardless, good job telling it.
Thank you. I do have a special little bonus paragraph here that I think would be a good way to end the episode.
Okay.
And this is pretty much word for word from Psychology Today, and it's actually on how to be an active bystander. So the intervention of bystanders is often the only reason that bullying and crimes actually stop. So the inaction described by the bystander effect can be reduced with awareness and training. One technique is to behave as if you are the first and only witness to a problem. Don't just assume that someone else is going to come up or to come along and deal with the problem, even if there are others around. Put yourself in the mindset that you are the only witness. Taking action can be as simple as shouting, "Hey, what's going on?" or "The police are on their way." Speaking up can empower others to take action as well. An active bystander is most effective when they assume that they are the only person taking charge. Giving direction to other bystanders, even just telling them to call 911, can be critical in successfully resolving the situation. Don't expect others to ask first. Even just saying stop or help is on the way can prevent further harm. Speak up using a calm, firm tone. Give others directions to get them involved and helping too. Do your best to provide safety, of the victim. And don't be afraid to ask for help. If you find yourself in a situation where you can reasonably help someone else without risking your own life, be an active bystander. Next time you encounter a situation where harm is coming to someone else, remember that even your words can save a life. So I think that is a great way to wrap things up, to learn a very important lesson. To not be part of the bystander effect, be an active bystander when it is safe to do so, obviously.
Right. Yes. Well, that was a great little snippet at the end. And as per usual, I will be posting photos of Carmen, Wanda, and Michelle on our socials. And then along with those photos, I will have the Rochester Police phone number accompanying as well. If you
And then,
saw something, but yep.
oh, I was just going to say, and special thanks because I always forget to do this. Medium.com, Psychology Today, All That's Interesting and the Serial Killer podcast were all helpful in creating this episode today.
Always thank our sources, cover our
Right.
tracks. But yes. So we will see, you will hear from us in a couple of weeks when I will be back with a fresh story for y'all. And deviants, until then, bye.
Bye.